Jess Sheeler, an outreach and career transition specialist at Job Corps, Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW Oshkosh, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Manji. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning and welcome to Education Matters. My name is Allison Erickson, and I'm your host today. I'm a reading specialist for Lakewood School in Twin Lakes, Wisconsin. I'm delighted to be here with you today to talk about the pivotal role parents play in education. Here to talk with us today is Dr. Dipesh Navsaria. Dr. Navsaria is a pediatrician working in the public interest. He blends the roles of physician, occasional children's librarian, educator, public health professional, and child health advocate. With graduate degrees in public health, children's librarianship, physician assistant studies, and medicine, he brings a unique combination of interests and experience together. Dr. Navsaria is an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and is the director of the MD-MPH program, as well as the medical director of the physician assistant program. Clinically, he has practiced primary care pediatrics with special interest in underserved populations. He's the founding medical director of Reach Out and Read Wisconsin. Dr. Navsaria is heavily involved in both training and in the practice of child health advocacy, writing and speaking publicly, locally, regionally, and nationally on early brain and child development, early literacy, and advocacy. He also has extensive involvement with the American Academy of Pediatrics at the state and national levels. Dr. Navsaria aims to educate the next generation of those who work with children and families in realizing how their professional roles include being involved in larger concepts of social policy and how they may affect the cognitive and socio-emotional development of children for their future benefit. I had the absolute pleasure of attending a presentation by Dr. Navsaria last year titled Books Build Better Brains, How Promoting Literacy is Key to Early Brain and Child Development. Good morning, Dr. Navsaria, and welcome to Education Matters. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much. It's a delight to be here. I'm pleased to be able to speak with you.
Thank you. So let's get started. Let's talk a little bit about Reach Out and Read. You're the founding medical director of Reach Out and Read Wisconsin. Could you tell us a little bit about Reach Out and Read and its mission?
Yeah, certainly. Reach Out and Read, which nationally is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, is a program that really takes the regular pediatric primary care checkup that kids get so many times in their early years, and it uses that opportunity to help structure a conversation between healthcare providers and parents. Really using the book as a frame, reading together as a frame. The healthcare provider walks into the room with a book in their hand, an age-appropriate, culture-appropriate, language-appropriate, developmentally appropriate book, hands it directly to the child. And while talking with the parent a little bit about how much time they spend sharing books together and doing other activities, they're skillfully and intentionally watching what does that child do with the book, how does the parent respond to the book, and so on. Because we know that all of these things help drive a child's development, and we use this as an opportunity to observe, gather data, inquire, support, encourage, model, coach, and offer suggestions around all these things. People think that we're a book giveaway program, but the reality is we're secretly a program to help support parents.
That's absolutely fantastic. How did the shift happen from medical providers, pediatricians in general, going from really just looking at is the child healthy in the sense of their, are they coughing, sneezing, to really looking at that brain development and what they're doing with books?
Yeah, it's a great question. Really, what we do in pediatrics, and I will say, when I say pediatrics, I'm talking about any provider of health services to children in a primary care setting. So that'll also include our friendly colleagues in family medicine, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and so on. So when we do pediatrics, right, a few decades ago, really, it was largely a science of infectious disease, right? The things that really harmed children were often things like meningitis and bloodstream infections and things of that nature. And in fact, it was only 100 years ago that a child who was born may not live to see age 5 because of the various infectious diseases out there. And then really three things happened over time, and it improved steadily over time. Sanitation, antibiotics, and immunizations. those things together have really changed how the experience of early childhood is for children, so that a relatively healthy child at birth is very likely, in fact, expected to reach adulthood, not just living, but thriving in an ideal sense of the word. So really, what we found was that we have been having to do less and less and less around those other things. We still immunize, of course, and still deal with ear infections and all that, but we're not admitting children for suspected meningitis anywhere the way we used to just 20 years ago, thanks to just two immunizations that have protected so many kids' lives against that. So what we've realized is that the single largest threat now to children is stuff that's always been there but got overshadowed by disease and death, which was really educational success, developmental success, and so on. And we're not as well equipped to handle that in healthcare. Healthcare is largely about, here's a problem, go fix it. Well, when you try to put a prevention, public health, more socio-emotional type of and developmental lens on it, it's much harder to do. But that's the change that's had to happen, and that's where pediatrics has really gone.
Right. We do look in education a lot at the interventions and what we can do, but it really does help to be more proactive. So thank you for that. How does Reach Out and Read work with other agencies focused on family engagement?
You know, it's been wonderful as Reach Out and Read has spread throughout Wisconsin. And I'll just take a moment to say that when we founded Reach Out and Read Wisconsin in December of 2010, that was about 50 plus clinics in the state that had sprung up doing it, you know, heard about it at a conference or something and worked directly with the National Center in Boston to get it going. But it's hard to, you know, adequately maintain good quality and support when they're all the way in Boston and, you know, clinics are here in Wisconsin. So when we founded Reach Out and Read Wisconsin, there was just about 50-plus clinics. I believe we hit about 239 clinics last week.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And we've had many, many still on the waiting list to join. Our capacity is actually somewhat limited by just being able to have adequate staff to be able to do the good job of quality and technical assistance and so on that we're trying to do. So one of the great things is as we've set up clinics or worked with clinics in throughout the state, some of them, you know, despite all the good intentions that we all have, we found that had never really reached out to other community organizations in this area because, you know, we're all busy. It's hard to kind of keep that up. And it's hard to say, oh, well, this is what we're doing for literacy because if you don't have a model for it. Well, Reach Out and Read offers that model. So as we provide the technical assistance and startup, some of the things we're suggesting to places are, have you called your local library? Have you talked to your local literacy agency? Do you know who they are? And so on and so forth. So it's actually helped build capacity and connections in these local communities that you know, we sitting in Madison or Milwaukee or wherever don't actually facilitate or need to know. But we've helped people that are actually living and working in the same community connect professionally around a shared goal, which has been really lovely to see.
Have you seen that happen in more rural communities as well?
Yes. And that also includes programs like home visiting, Head Start, in some cases WIC and others. Anywhere where people are pushing up against the lives of children and families, they're hearing the Reach Out and Read message. And I have to be honest here, so many of those agencies are so happy that healthcare providers are talking about this stuff because we can all reinforce and reamplify each other's messages in a really wonderful way. And it's really set up a different sort of collaboration. And I want to say, you know, clinics are not generally out there looking for more work. They're busy. Like, they are under the gun for so many things.
Right.
And yet they're lining up to do Reach Out and Read, which I think speaks to the power of the Reach Out and Read model and the promise that it really holds for clinicians who say, yes, this is why I applied to medical school or PA school or NP school or whatever. This is key. And this is central to what I'm doing. And that's why I want to do this, even though I have all these other things that are pressing on my time.
Right. What drives your passion for promoting literacy?
You know, I think that, you know, I'm probably one of the first people who heard about Reach Out and Read somewhere early in my career, so to speak. I was an undergrad in Boston doing some child development research, you know, all the kind of research that everyone needs to do in order to, you know, apply to, you know, med school and all that stuff. And Reach Out and Read had started just recently. It was the first place it started, just kind of down the hall from us. And I heard about it, but I had no opportunity to really learn more about it. But as I went through training, through physician assistant school, and then working as a PA for a while in pediatrics, I saw the Reach Out and Read model in action and all. I've always loved books. I mean, as a young child, I books were my best friend. And I think that to see this idea that, wow, healthcare providers are talking about reading in checkups, like, you know, in 1989, that was a completely crazy idea. And now it may sound a little crazy to some people, but at least in healthcare, when you say to pediatricians, reach out and read, almost anyone who does primary care pediatrics says, oh yeah, I know what that is. And they don't sit there questioning it. They don't laugh at it. They're like, oh yeah, that's important.
That it makes sense and it's a key to future success for everyone.
It does, and also it, you know, here's the other thing. So many of us see children who are failing in 8th grade, 10th grade, 12th grade, or earlier, and we feel largely helpless to make a difference. We don't know what to do at that point because it's not something we're trained in, and it's something that really is largely in the education world's wheelhouse, but recognizing that, well, they needed to, you know, the factors that contributed to that failure really, you know, were in place in infancy and toddlerhood. So it really becomes an issue of saying, rather than me sitting here and getting frustrated with myself at not being able to solve the single biggest threat to that child's well-being, let's do something to prevent that upfront, early, so that we're not having to deal.
Right. So you see reading as a fundamental skill for success?
Yes, I do. You know, there's a lot of different skills out there, and I want to be very clear that I think they're important in many different ways. But if you want to look at something that we can point at that's very concrete, if you can't read well, then you're not going to be able to succeed well in the educational world. There's a truism that gets thrown around the education world sometimes that up to fourth grade or so, you're learning to read, and after fourth grade, you're reading to learn.
Right.
So if you aren't fluently reading by about fourth grade or so, though, after that, you know, you're missing everything that comes after that. And we live in a society where the ability to do this thing we call reading, I mean, let's stop for a second here and think about what's reading. Reading is taking little marks on a page or a screen even, right? And it's decoding that and extracting meaning from it. And we, if you read well, you're looking at large amounts of text and you're extracting meaning from it very quickly. This is a massive success of the human brain, of civilization, of education. As my colleague Perry Klass says, this is a triumph of the early brain, that all these things come together that allow us to do this incredible thing of decoding text. And if you're not decoding text fluently, a lot of the opportunities in the world are really lost to you. You're locked out of them. We used to have, you know, if a kid couldn't read well and all, well, okay, maybe they were good with spatial relations and moving things around and how things fit together, right? They could end up being a really wonderful automobile mechanic. Well, look at cars today, right? There's an issue. You're plugging it into a computer. These enormous manuals with all this stuff. Some cars are like largely built on computer code. It's not the same thing it used to be. So even jobs like that are starting to get, you know, closed off if you can't read fluently. And the universe of possible career options for someone who can't read fluently is getting smaller and smaller. So if we can at least deal with the reading part, I'm not pretending that reading is the only issue, you know, here, but if we can at least deal with that, then we know that it's at least offering up a huge array of more options than there would have been otherwise.
You're so right. So you have a prescription for reading that you give families at your wellness checks. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because it's very similar to what teachers say every day.
Yeah, It is. And, you know, I have to say one of the ironies is that, you know, I walk around saying, you know, read to your child from birth every day for even just a few minutes. And, you know, I say it and people say, oh, that's wonderful. It's wonderful. And then in the back of my head, I'm thinking, yes, and teachers and librarians have been telling you this for decades. But
we appreciate the backup. The support helps us a lot.
Me, but OK, I'll take it, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I have to say, I didn't think of the prescription to read. It's a concept that's been around for a while. I first saw it actually in an old Reach Out and Read kind of the materials. But I resurrected it. And the thing is, it really sticks in people's heads. When I hand you, it looks just like a old-fashioned paper prescription pad and is configured just like that. And it says, share books together, you know, and then it says, you know, for X number of minutes a day, at bedtime, you know, as needed. And then it says refills available at your local library. And I give these to families. And I also use it when I do advocacy work at both the state and U.S. capitals for Reach Out and Read. And people remember this because I honestly mean it. Just because of everything I've been telling you, I honestly mean it when I say this may be the most important prescription I ever hand a family because of the lifelong implications of what acts like that do in terms of a child's well-being and long-term future and life course.
I have chills. That's exactly what we need is more people asking all of our families, our parents, our kids to share books together. Could you talk what that means? What does it mean to share a book together?
Yeah. Oh, and that's a good point because, you know, the first version of my prescriptions used to simply say read books. And I realized that actually isn't the message that I want to send. The message is about the share books together, right? The sharing and the together is actually what's key. Because here's the thing. Yes, literacy. And the more that children are exposed to books and read to from a young age, the more likely they are to know what the form of a book is and to be able to decode text fluently and understand that text conveys meaning, right? There's this thing called emergent literacy that a kid who's two, even if they've been around books, doesn't necessarily get that you as an adult, when you're reading aloud from a picture book, that you're reading words. They think you're telling the story by looking at the pictures. But a three-year-old starts to get it, that there's something about those black marks on the page and that is telling you what to say. You know, so that gets pushed along when a child is exposed to books. But I also don't want parents to get this idea that if you simply hold a book out to a child or just give them a book and walk away, then that's it. The kid's not going to know what to do with a book if they've never seen one before and don't have any idea what to do with it. It's really about the together piece because we know that the single driver of development, that the only thing that's been shown to make a difference is interaction with other loving, caring, responsive human beings, whether that's the parents or teachers or relatives or whoever's in their environment. So this is really important because I will point out that there's no DVD, TV program, or app that has been shown to do anything beneficial for the development of a child under age, let's say, 2 or 3 years old. Okay? There's data in some four-year-olds for some things and not many things. But
and all dependent on time.
You know. Yeah. But for the younger kids, there's nothing. So all these apps that are being hawked and, you know, DVDs and whatever, oh, it's good for your child's brain. It's complete nonsense. They're making it all up because they want to make a quick buck. As one of my colleagues says, there is no app to replace your lap. That it's really about that interaction together with a loving, caring adult. So share books together really, I think, gets the idea across of, well, you know, it's not that I just want your child to look at books, and it's fine if they look at books on their own, if they're comfortable with it and all that stuff, there's nothing wrong with that. But I want you to sit down and share the book together with your child. And this, you know, sometimes we can say things to parents like, well, just talk to your child, read with your child, play with your child. Well, that's all well and good, but if you yourself aren't really sure how to do that, because maybe it was never modeled for you in, you know, your upbringing or the environment that you're living in now, and you're not really sure if you're doing it right, and maybe you're worried that you'll mess your kid up because maybe you didn't do so well in school yourself, and how do you know that you're playing with them the right way or talking to them the right way? Well, with a book, at least, it's the framework, right? Read this book aloud together with your child. Now, that's not to say it's so easy, because squirmy toddlers are hard to read to. They have a short attention span, and that's normal. So one of the things we try to do is talk about that, help parents anticipate that, and not get discouraged when the kid doesn't want to sit still and listen quietly to the book. We tell them it's okay to go backwards in the book. It's okay to pick out random pages. It's okay to even just talk about the pictures. I don't care if you don't actually read the story. I'm not going to make you or the child write an essay on it. So it's really about this thing that we call dialogic reading, having this conversation over the book. And when we say share books together, what we're doing is we're giving a parent a framework for how to do that interaction, which may have never been modeled for them. And then we try to help them be successful and confident at it.
That's so important. Just those daily conversations, the importance of language, and actually speaking, having conversations with your child is really important. Exactly. Thank you for pointing that out. I just want to remind our listeners, you're listening to WGTD, HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. And you're listening to Education Matters. I'm Allison Erickson. My guest today is Dr. Dipesh Navsaria, and we're talking about the pivotal role parents play in education. Welcome back, Dr. Navsaria.
Thank you.
We're going to switch gears here a little, and we're going to talk about some literacy statistics. Yes, we're going to talk about math, as any good reading specialist does. How many children under 5 are being read to daily in Wisconsin?
So these numbers are actually a little difficult to sometimes parse out because, if somebody asks you, do you read to your child daily? The answer is yes, of course I do.
Sure.
Bias there towards things that are more desirable socially.
Yes.
The best data that we have, and it can be a little old sometimes, probably indicates that it's somewhere around half of all kids are getting daily reading, meaning at least 10 minutes or so. However, the real issue is that these numbers are dramatically different based on socioeconomic status. That the numbers are much, much lower for kids that are living in poverty and much higher in those that are doing financially very well off, although those numbers are not zero either, which is why Reach Out and Read actually is applicable across all income groups. And again, I want to highlight, this is not about people being bad parents or being ignorant. It's about not necessarily having the support to know how to do things well or not being confident in their own ability to do things well. And I think that really plays a big role, particularly if they're getting marketed to about put your child in front of this device or DVD or whatever, as I said earlier.
So I did see, I follow you on Twitter. You're one of my favorite people to retweet. Did you retweet something about virtual and online preschools over the weekend? And how do you feel about virtual preschools?
Yes, I do. And wow, this is one of those things that when you first hear it, you think this must be an article out of The Onion or some other parody.
The end of the world as we know it?
Yeah. And it turns out that there are places that are pushing these concepts of online preschool. Now, I want to be fair here and try to give the most charitable interpretation to the motives of people who are setting that up. I think they are recognizing that early education is expensive. It's also very hard to have it in all the places that you need it, even in urban areas, and that's even more difficult in rural areas. And I think they feel, well, if we can somehow scale this and do it really well, then great, it'll be cheaper and we'll reach more people and wonderful, kids will benefit. The problem is that there's no evidence that it actually does anything. We know that young kids don't seem to learn off the screen anywhere near as well. And we also know that it's, again, those human responsive nurturing interactions that are just not going to happen through a screen unless that relationship already exists. You know, if you love grandma and she Skypes with you, a 4 or 5 year old may actually gain a lot from Skyping with grandma. But if you've never met grandma and, you know, you're Skyping with her 1 or 2 times, probably that engagement is not going to be there. So I think that the online preschool thing, I would not recommend that there be any money put into it or effort unless the proponents of it can show absolutely stellar evidence that it works well.
Right. Would that harken back to how important play and oral language development is for children? So are children going to have the same social skills, academic skills from a screen that they're going to get from playing in an actual preschool room?
Yeah, probably not. But I, you know, the thing is that it's not that all things that happen on screens are exactly the same way that all play is not the same. You know, so I want to be careful of making very broad generalizations. But on the whole, you know, and certainly spatial relations and things like that, as well as imaginative play, there are some apps and things that might force you to use your imagination more, but a lot of times it offers so many specifics because it can, you know, we can program so many different things, that it takes away imagination, it takes away creativity, and it also takes away the challenge of dealing with human interactions, which are inherently difficult and variable and change, but are so necessary to exist in the world that we live in. So, you know, a computer or a tablet or a phone is going to do simply what it's programmed to. It's not going to have a bad day and be grouchy and not want to play with you that day. Or it's not going to, you know, be feeling ill and act differently. Or it's not going to be having a great day and feeling really creative and coming up with things that you really love and enjoy and can start to riff off of and all that. You know, so these human interactions are really important. And I want to say a quick thing about the phrase kind of socio-emotional development or skills, because we toss this around a lot, and I think a lot of people, a lot of listeners may think, oh yeah, socio-emotional skills. I don't really know what that means, and I don't know, it sounds kind of hazy. And the way I described it recently to someone is that gross motor skills, fine motor skills, language skills basically allow us to walk, to write, and to speak with one another. Socio-emotional skills teach us about when we should use those abilities and when we shouldn't.
Okay. Thank you for that. And let's go just change gears a little bit here, and I absolutely adore your presentation skills. Could you elaborate on the statement that I stole from your presentation? Change the first 5 years and you can change everything?
Yeah, this is basically a strong way of saying that what happens early matters. You know, the human brain is very interesting. Our brains, when we're born, our brains are not yet fully formed. And human babies are actually astonishingly helpless. And if you look at, say, baby goats, they're born and within like minutes, they are standing up. You know, and they're wandering around and all sorts of things. Whereas it takes us a whole year to learn how to walk. And that's because if the human brain got any larger, the head would be too big for babies to be born. So functionally, even though babies are a baby born at roughly 40 weeks of gestation is on time, their brain is actually still not fully formed. The first year of life is quote-unquote like the fourth trimester of pregnancy in the sense of brain development. So that brain needs to learn a lot of things. It has some built-in things like protection from danger, you know, and safety and looking for food and things like that. But a lot of its skills are not yet developed. And if the baby's in an environment where they're not getting fed well, where there's danger, where they're not safe, you know, so they can't sleep, their housing's unstable, all those things, their brain starts to wire to basically teach them to do all those things, right? Look for shelter, keep themselves safe, look for food, etc. Their brain is not going to wire for loving, caring relationships. They're not going to wire for learning, for curiosity, for creativity, for all those sorts of things, because you're focused on survival. Survival has to come first. So when a child's challenged by all these things in the first 5 years of life, then we end up with a child who shows up in preschool or kindergarten with a brain that's primed for safety and survival and self-defense. And then is it any wonder that they quote-unquote act out? And the question we should be asking when kids do that at this young, young age shouldn't be, oh, what's wrong with you? The question should be, what happened to you? Right? What happened that made it so that you're coming in with a brain that's wired for survival and not one that's wired for creativity and exploration and learning and all that? Now, 5 years, the brain is developing so quickly in the early years. The first 1,000 days of life, even the first 3 years, is even more critical. But it's not to say that you can't fix things later. There's always opportunities to change and remediate, even into adulthood. It just takes a lot more work, a lot more effort, a lot more expense, and a lot more support. So if we can get it right early on in those first 5 years, we can actually change the trajectory of so many human beings in their life course. And we all are better off for it as a society when that happens, because we are now not trying to figure out how do we support this person who can't contribute to society easily or well. We're instead using them. They're part of the support that we all give to one another, whether it's through their presence, their accomplishments, their tax dollars, you know, whatever it may be.
Okay, so if a child's brain is built in that survival mode and they've reached kindergarten, first grade, what are some suggestions you have for how to help at that point?
So
how do we flip that switch from survival to learning and thriving?
Yeah, so from an education perspective, I would say that the first thing is that teachers should learn about trauma-informed care, where you're aware of the role that trauma has, and learning responses that doesn't trigger that trauma further. And there's a lot of work being done out there, a lot of workshops and speakers and all that who specialize in doing that in an education setting. And I would recommend definitely looking into that and being trained in how to handle those things well for whatever age you're working with. From a broader societal perspective, we need to make sure that there's appropriate therapy. There is evidence-based therapy out there. We don't have enough people who know how to do it. We need to make sure that health insurance pays for it. And here's the most important thing. We need to make sure that the family is actually capable of following up with it. Family might say, yes, that's wonderful. I'm so glad you found me this therapist and they're paid for by my insurance. I can't go twice a week, for 45-minute sessions because I'm going to get fired from my job. You know, families are sometimes getting threatened with losing their job for just getting one evaluation done. So we need to make sure that all of those things are falling into place for those results to happen.
Right. You're so right. Are there any examples you can give us of adverse experiences that we might not automatically think of that children can be exposed to? So we often think, oh, a child was physically beaten. Are there any other of those hidden experiences we don't think of automatically that would cause a child to be more survival than not?
So the obvious ones are the things like physical, emotional or sexual abuse, and things of that nature. But some of the things are also kind of what's happening in their vicinity. So one, it could be simply physical or emotional neglect, right? That no one's actually actively trying to harm you, but they're also not meeting your needs for whatever reason is going on. Emotional neglect could be a consequence of severe maternal depression or paternal depression, you know. And if you don't have insurance and can't get yourself treated, then, you know, you're just doing the best you can. But that does still have an effect on the child. Those sorts of things, or having somebody in the household who's been incarcerated, right, says something about that, the general environment in the vicinity of that child. These are examples of the classic adverse childhood experiences that were delineated in a 1998 study, which was the first time that they looked at large, large populations, 17,000 middle-class, college-educated, mostly Caucasian people. Okay, so this is not actually a study of poverty. This is a study of really the middle class. And they found that when they asked, did these things ever happen to you as a child, the numbers were sky high of people saying yes. I mean, a quarter of them said, yes, I was physically abused as a child. The smallest number was 1 in 20, you know. So these are incredibly common. And then when they looked to see how did these things, these numbers correlate to what happened to their health later on as an adult or later on in childhood, They found higher risk of developmental delay. They found more adult heart disease, of all things, 50 years later. Right? And there's a lot of work, which I could go on for hours about, and I won't, about the biological mechanisms, about this thing we call epigenetics and these stress hormones like cortisol, and how this may explain some of the really poor health outcomes we see in people who had adverse experiences early in childhood.
You don't often think about that. What happened as a child is going to affect you as an adult, and it is just a pivotal point in your life that can affect the rest of your life.
And I really want to point out how shockingly common it is, again, that this is a study of the middle class, and this study has been repeated over and over and over again, and there's even state-specific ones. Wisconsin has one as well. And we're seeing about the same numbers. There was actually a conference I was presenting at on this topic of trauma and all. And during one of the short sessions between speakers, they actually handed out the little clickers, the audience response system things, because those are anonymous. And they went through the 10 questions that were asked in the ACEs study. Did this happen to you yet as a child, yes or no? And they had people answer, because, of course, you have no idea who's giving these answers, so it protects their anonymity. And the numbers of the people in the room attending this conference on trauma were eerily, eerily similar to what we've seen in past studies. You just look around the room and say, my goodness, it is everywhere. It really is everywhere. We just don't talk about it.
Wow, that is shocking. It's
absolutely
shocking. So I guess, how are parents and caregivers a vital component to combating this? You know, we often see as educators and families an academic gap that exists even on day one of kindergarten. What can we do?
Yeah, so here's the thing, right? People sometimes say, oh, you know, how are we going to solve homelessness and hunger and all these sorts
massive
of things?
Problems?
Well, and that's all another talk about poverty and ways to approach it. But barring fixing those root problems, we know that one of the most powerful protective factors against that early adversity is actually the ability of children to engage in these loving, nurturing, responsive relationships. So I don't want anyone to think that we cannot allow bad things to happen to children ever, otherwise it's all lost, right? That's not the message here. The message here is that if bad things happen, if stressful circumstances occur, if they have good, strong, buffering relationships, that actually protects them against these long-term things. It's the key protectant. And sometimes if those relationships don't exist, suddenly they'd have this thing we call toxic stress. But if they do exist, it becomes tolerable stress. You know, I'm not going to say it's a great thing, but it's an okay thing. They'll be fine. And that really kind of leads to a lot of, if whatever we can do to keep families together and allow families to be successful together, that is going to play out. That is going to make a huge difference in terms of at least allowing them to be successful even in the face of adversity.
I appreciate that, that we can overcome adversity, we can keep going. So I'm going to inevitably ask you this.
If I could just point out one more thing here, actually. I keep talking about parents, and I think parents are their child's first and best teachers and are the single greatest influence on a child's life. But even in circumstances where the parent is unable to do that, maybe they're not there physically, right? Or maybe they just have too much else going on themselves. That role could be played by another caring, responsive adult. It could be, you know, a sports coach. It could be a tutor. It could be a teacher, right? I'm not arguing that they should be replacing the role of parents, but for a child to know, just to know that someone is there who will listen to them and love them and accept them the way they are, that even that knowledge that they're there can be tremendously affirming and protective for them. And I think that's really critical to recognize that all the research points to, this is Yuri Bronfenbrenner summarized all the research beautifully once when he was asked, what's the most important thing? What should we be making sure we invest in? He said, well, every child should have a loving, caring adult who's absolutely crazy about them and can show it. And they said, that's it? And they said, yeah, that's really what all the research shows. So there you go.
That's amazing. And thank you for pointing out that we are a team in this. From coaches, parents, teachers, that we're a team and we're here to help. And our medical providers are here to help as well in every way we can. And I do have to end as a teacher and ask you, what's your favorite book?
So I'll give you two answers to that quickly. My favorite children's book is a picture book, is Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are. It's just a wonderful romp through the world of a child's emotions and imagination and so on. And there's some beautiful little elements in it that I think are just so wonderful in terms of what early readers should be exposed to. And then if you're going to ask about kind of adult level books, the book that nearly made me go to grad school for English literature and forget all this other stuff was actually John Milton's Paradise Lost.
Really?
Yeah. Nearly ended up as a Milton scholar. So.
And we'd be at a loss for it. I do have about two more minutes left here, Dr. Nafsaria. Would you like to say anything else?
No, I think that, you know, I appreciate the opportunity here, and I really want folks to realize so much of our society is siloed, right? We sit here in the education world and the health world and the policy world and the social work world. Children, young children don't care about our world. They don't care about our job descriptions. They don't care about what graduate degree we got. They care about someone trying to help them, and they need that help, whether it's coming from the education world or the health world or whatever. So we need to kind of get out of our heads sometimes and say, hey, guys, it's not about us. It's about the kids here. So what can we do together to really make sure that that makes a difference for them and that we are doing this collectively for their benefit and not to think about ourselves, our budgets, our institutions, and our structures?
You're so correct. It is a partnership, and we all do work together. I just want to thank you so much, Dr. Nafsaria, for being our guest today on Education Matters. And
you are very welcome.
I do have all of your information here, so if you would like to learn more about Dr. Nafsaria, you can follow him on Twitter at Nafsaria, Facebook at Dr. Librarian, and on his website at www.nafsaria.com or LinkedIn at Dipesh Nafsaria. You've been listening to WGTD HD FM, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of the pivotal role parents play in education with Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. Thank you for listening, and I'm Allison Erickson.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Rhea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, that's what keeps you coming back. Visit jackandrea.com for more information.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the City of Racine and Public Health Departments would like to remind the public of the city's ordinance that prohibits animals in most parks, beaches, cemeteries, and public swimming areas. Direct inquiries to 262-635-7772.
This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Lenny Aquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, and Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist at the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside. Community Matters shares its time slot with the WGTD Radial Theater. And now, here's today's program.
Good morning. This is Lenny Aquinta for Community Matters, and our topic today is social determinants of health, with a focus on infant mortality in Kenosha and, of course, Racine and the surrounding area. We're going to look at it through the public school perspective. My guest today is Juan Torres. One is the Kenosha Unified School District Coordinator of Diversity, Student, and Family Engagement. He's seen aspects of these problems from every vantage point. Good morning.